My name is David Southall. I'm the author of several books, including History of Organised Crime and Secrets and Lies. The way I really got into this, I think it was as a child, I had a natural curiosity. And behind the woods in which I lived in Essex was a microwave relay tower, which sort of really dominated the landscape. And in the 70s, microwave relay towers weren't very common. And it piqued my curiosity. And I went through a whole of my childhood asking absolutely everybody, what is this, what's going on here? And eventually, in the very early 80s, I read a book by Duncan Campbell, which explained that the bit of the landscape I'd been most puzzled by and spent 12 years sort of growing up in the shadow of was actually something called part of Backbone Britain, which was the communications system which was set up to survive a nuclear war and to provide the command structure and communication structure in a post-nuclear Holocaust situation. And really from that sort of first sort of discovering my first state secret, as it were, and my relationship to it, I think really kept a interest and piqued an interest in sort of following those type of stories. And from my childhood onwards, I think I gravitated towards journalism and research, and really it held a fascination which sort of became a lifelong fascination.
So how did that become an interest in the Mafia?
Well, for me, the Mafia is a really good way of looking at what I call the conspiracy of the everyday. Organised crime is a really great model of how a lot of corporations and a lot of government collusion with corporations actually works. So it's a very good way of talking to people and examining how the hidden powers help shape our everyday reality and are the conspiracy of the everyday. And organised crime is a very visible way of looking at it and a way of researching it. But I think the model behind organised crime has a lot of parallels which are very translatable into other areas.
But organised crime isn't really very visible, is it? Most people, organised crime may be going on, but they may well not know it's there.
I think organised crime is actually incredibly visible. What you don't perceive quite often is the chain of organised crime. You're very much aware of the dodgy gear being sold to you. Everybody knows somebody who is dealing something or the other. What we don't often think about is the structure behind that. But actually investigating that and actually laying some of that bare and starting to see some of those relationships isn't that hard to do.
So what is the structure behind it then? I mean, you may see a drive past a drug dealer on the street or whatever, but I mean, how high does it go, structure behind the dealer on the street?
These days, even the most localised form of organised crime will be part of a structure which will lead to a transnational criminal organisation. That transnational criminal organisation, what you are seeing on your local street in your local area, will have an impact not just at a national level in this country, but in several other countries. And the level of collusion and integration with legitimate business and government is so integrated that what you see happening goes all of the way back to UK government, government in other countries. You know, if we're talking about dealing of cocaine, it will have an impact in Colombia, China, Australia, Brazil. The chain is so integrated now that your local organised crime, that tip of the iceberg, is just the start of a huge chain of consequence which will circle the world.
Is it possible, do you think, for the police to smash these crime rings?
I actually really believe that the basis of, if you want to say, dismantling organised crime, making an impact on organised crime, it's never about more police numbers, it's never about increased budgets, it is never about increased powers. If you talk to, as I have done, anybody who is highly placed in a transnational criminal organisation, there are two things which really, really worry them. One of which is tackling prohibition, because prohibition is one of the biggest sources of any criminal activity and criminal market. And it's the other really big issue for them is actually making business much more difficult for them to do, which is all about tackling poverty. Tackling poverty at a local level, tackling poverty at a global level. if you talk,
why does that make business more difficult for them?
Because, you know, you're quite often the very nature of organised crime is exploitative. It's very difficult to exploit those who are in secure financial situations. Criminal activity, whether it's illegal immigration operations, illegal prostitution operations, if there isn't a base of poverty, it's very difficult to exploit people. So if you tackle poverty and you tackle prohibition, you're actually undermining criminal enterprises in a way that increased police powers, increased police resources can never hope to do. And one of the guys I interviewed for the History of Organised Crime, there's an Albanian mafia organiser in the UK, a guy called Zef Nano, who was very closely involved in illegal immigration, drug running operations and illegal prostitution in the UK. And he was very clear and very explicit that he would not be able to thrive in terms of what he would see as entrepreneurship if there wasn't a base poverty which he was able to exploit for prostitution and immigration, and if there wasn't prohibition for the drugs. And so for him, the two biggest worries were taking those away, not increasing police powers, you know, not increasing police resources, police numbers. Those have very limited operational problems, which any big transnational criminal organisation can always get around by bribery, other routes, you know, redeploying resources. Actually tackling organised crime is much more fundamental, and it really requires real political bravery, real bravery by us as people to say, you know, we are going to refuse to engage in allowing that level of poverty to exist, that level of prohibition to exist, because those are what permit and allow organised criminal activity to thrive. You want to tackle organised crime, tackle poverty, tackle prohibition.
Your latest book, though, is Secrets and Lies, which is taking a little bit of a different tack, looking at various different conspiracies and giving a bit of a test as to seeing whether there's any basis to those conspiracies. Why did you decide you wanted to do that?
I think there's a huge literature now about conspiracy theory, and that's very interesting and it's very entertaining. But quite often it sidelines some of the very important issues. And what I wanted to do is write a book of what I call conspiracy fact, things which if you actually looked at them or were told about them, your natural inclination would be to dismiss them as absolutely impossible. These are mad conspiracy theories. But if you then actually went and did any basic research, having read the book and read any of the entries in it, you would actually be able to establish very simply, very quickly, very effectively, from authoritative, independent resources, that this was conspiracy fact. The operations which the CIA did, or an operation by the Catholic Church, or by a major corporation, which if I told you, you would naturally assume would be a mad, paranoid fantasy, is absolutely verifiable fact and a matter of actual record, which is very easy for you, anybody, to go away and verify. And so I wanted to deal in a whole different literature, which was conspiracy fact, not conspiracy theory.
Why should anybody trust you? You were a spin doctor for the supermarket.
I've been a spin doctor for many organisations. I actually don't ask anybody to trust me. What I've been trying to do is lay out information. And I don't want people to actually take what you say, I say, or any other journalistic source necessarily will say as fact, as truth. We now live in an age of access to information where we as individual citizens can engage much more proactively in checking and verifying what we are told. And I think we've all got a duty to actually go away and verify and check and become our own researchers, become our own intelligence operations. Not just become the media, but become the bits behind the media, which we don't often see, and actually check this stuff out for ourselves. What I tell you, or what you tell anybody, will never have the power of what they discover for themselves. And what I tried to do with Secrets and Lies was provide enough signposts in any given entry that somebody could go away, if their interest was actually taken by the story, go away and verify it for themselves.
But isn't that what the newspapers and journalists are supposed to do? Check these facts for the public. I mean, it's very difficult for every member of the public to go and check every fact in every story.
That's how it may have worked in the past. These days, I think we have a culture of lazy journalism. and certainly on a lot of the mainstream media, the level of fact-checking, the level of investigation in stories is actually of a lower quality than what you will find with a lot of citizen journalists. Not everybody has the resources, not everybody has the time to check everything, but make a start. If something interests you, pursue it, follow it, investigate. There is no hierarchy now which says what you will read or hear broadcast is going to be more verifiable, more accurate than what you can check for yourself. And engage with the stories that interest you. Check, research, follow. You haven't got the situation now where you can trust without question any source of media. And I don't want a populace, I don't want people that would trust any source of media, even an apparently independent source of media, and wouldn't want to engage and wouldn't be curious enough to actually do some research for themselves and to do some thinking for themselves. In Secrets and Lies, I was asked, I asked if I could write, an afterword. And it was only actually going to be a few words, but they gave me 1,500. But it came down to, the biggest lie you have been told is that you are powerless to affect change. And the biggest secret is why you actually then, when you realise you have a huge amount of power as an individual, don't act on it. And I really do believe that we're coming into a position now where our access to technology, the new type of networks which are evolving, really do give us all the opportunity to interrogate and investigate at a much higher level than we could do 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. And so if we go back to the type of journalism, the excellent journalism we used to see in the 30s, that's disappeared very largely from mainstream media. And if you want to actually go back to tracing that and being part of that, do it yourself.